Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Music Review. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about music from such sources as the New York Times, the News and Observer, the Week Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Classic FM. Music Review is underwritten by Bill McClure, tuning pianos in the Raleigh area since 1968. For more information or to schedule a piano tuning appointment, please call 919-779-1755. This program is designed to provide the latest coverage of classical, folk, jazz, country, rock, and pop music news. But first, these musical trivia questions. Today's trivia questions come to us from AARP, the magazine, November 2022 issue. Question number one. Thurl Ravenscroft sang "You're a Mean One, Mr. Grinch" in the 1966 classic How the Grinch Stole Christmas. What non-holiday fictional character did Ravenscroft famously voice? Was that A, Darth Vader? Was it B, Tony the Tiger? Was it C, Bugs Bunny? Or was it D, Alvin from the Chipmunks? The guy who sang the Grinch song also played which fictional character? And question number two, which comic actor sang the now gold-certified The Hanukkah Song? Was that A, Adam Sandler, B, Bob Newhart, C, Steve Martin, or D, Jim Carrey? The Hanukkah Song. Which comic actor recorded that tune? The answers to these two important trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. Our transitions come to us from the website onthisday.com, and today, quote-unquote, is the weekend of December the 9th. Well, it was on this very day, back in 1803, that composer Louis Hector Berlioz was born. Berlioz was known for such compositions as Symphonie Fantastique. Berlioz, born today, 1803. And it was 38 years ago today, 1984, that the single Do They Know It's Christmas was released by Band-Aid. That group was assembled to aid in famine relief. 1984 today. Mozart's Requiem introduces our classical music news. It's titled, Does Listening to Mozart Make Kids Smarter? This is by the editors of Encyclopedia Britannica. One of the most tenacious myths in parenting is the so-called Mozart effect, which says that listening to music by the Austrian composer Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart will increase a child's intelligence. The idea has been promoted by advocates for arts education and by retailers who spell and sell special recordings of Mozart's works for infants and toddlers. Some pregnant women have even gone so far as to play Mozart recordings on headphones pressed against their bellies. And it's not hard to see how Mozart's name became associated with accelerated development. He was history's greatest child prodigy, performing astonishing feats of memory and musical dexterity for kings and queens at an age when many of us were content with tunelessly mumbling through I'm a little teapot, and eating the occasional crayon. So, if you have kids or you're expecting to have them, how seriously should you take the Mozart effect? Is the child who is deprived of hearing Mozart in the cradle doomed to a life of mediocrity? Are you a bad parent if Junior doesn't even know eine kleine Nachtmusik? Relax. There's no scientific evidence that listening to Mozart improves children's cognitive abilities. The whole idea comes from a small study done in 1993, which found that college students who listened to Mozart's Sonata for Two Pianos in D major showed modest improvement in a test of spatial reasoning. This finding was later stretched into something more extravagant by the musician and entrepreneur Don Campbell, who in 1997 published the bestseller, The Mozart Effect, Tapping the Power of Music to Heal the Body, Strengthen the Mind, and Unlock the Creative Spirit. Campbell's claims about the miraculous powers of Mozart's music were repeated endlessly in the media and fueled a craze for Mozart-based enrichment activities. In 1998, for example, the governor of Georgia requested funds to send classical music CDs to all parents of newborns in the state. Since then, scientists have examined the claim that Mozart boosts intelligence and found no evidence for it. The original experiment with college students was reviewed in 1999, and the increase in the students' spatial skills was found to be negligible. In 2007, the German Federal Ministry of Education and Research commissioned a team of experts to examine the scientific literature regarding Mozart and child development, and they found no reason to believe that it boosted intelligence. More recent research comes to the same conclusion. Richard Milner indicates in What Does Science Actually Say About the Mozart Effect in Babies, published in Grunge.com on November 23, 2022, that the Mozart effect is more of a myth spread by well-intended parents eager to provide, quote-unquote, the best to their children's development. Milner concludes that the real benefits from music come from playing an instrument with one's own body, not merely listening to it. So beyond the Mozart effect hype, what exactly are the benefits of your child learning to play an instrument or of an actual musical education? The best answer would be musical training makes your child better at music. If someone practices karate, they become better at karate. If someone practices French, they get better at French. If someone plays the flute, they get better at the flute. Action is key, not passive listening. The 20th century's most gifted songwriters invariably describe childhood engagement with music and being encouraged by parents to play and sing. Paul McCartney, Dolly Parton, and Neil Young, to name a few. We're not saying that your child is going to be the next Brahms if they take 60-minute piano lessons twice a week, but they'll definitely understand music better than if they didn't. But what about other benefits? As a study published in Frontiers in Neuroscience explains, children with musical training perform better at attention and memory recall tasks, which should come as no surprise. They also have greater activity in areas of the brain associated with auditory encoding, also no shock, and executive functions connected to tasks like reading. Research and technology, a couple of new developments here. They're reported in Time Magazine, November 21 through 28, 2022 issue. In entertainment and gaming, you have the Roly Seaboard Rise 2, synthesizing new sounds. The instrument that brought the piano into the digital age just got its first upgrade in several years. Roly's original Seaboard Rise keyboard replaced piano keys with pressure-responsive silicone key waves, giving musicians the ability to bend and shape notes without knobs or faders or pedals. The 25-key first iteration enabled the unique sounds of the hit TV show Stranger Things and platinum albums by Drake, Ed Sheeran, and others. The 49-key 4-octave Seaboard Rise 2 introduces guitar-inspired silicone frets to give users more control. This change, along with other adjustments to the shape of the Seaboard's key waves, dramatically improves both the approachability and performance of the instrument, says Roly's Danny Seeger. This is published by Jared Linzone in that Time magazine issue. And by the way, that's spelled R-O-L-I is the name of the product. And in accessibility, we have this item, Poly, P-O-L-L-Y, digital braille. When visually impaired children learn braille in a classroom, their teachers can't let them know how they're doing. But many of those students don't have braille readers at home to help them. Now they can use Poly, a Wi-Fi-enabled device developed by American Printing House for the Blind and Tinkerbell Labs that provides Braille learners with instant audio feedback and allows teachers to assign and assess homework remotely. Instead of a standard metal or plastic slate used with paper, learners can write and correct mistakes using Poly's electronic Braille slate and stylus, the world's first. This article was written by Novid Parsi in that same Time magazine. Fleetwood Mac's Rhiannon introduces our rock and pop music news. It's titled, Christine McVie, Fleetwood Mac keyboardist, dies at 79. This is published in CBSNews.com by Gina Martinez on the 30th of November, 2022. Christine McVie, who sang and played keyboards for Fleetwood Mac, has died following a short illness, her family confirmed. She was 79. She passed away peacefully at hospital this morning, Wednesday, November 30th, 2022, following a short illness. She was in the company of her family. We would like everyone to keep Christine in their hearts and remember the life of an incredible human being and revered musician who was loved universally. R.I.P. Christine McVie, the family added. McVie, born Christine Perfect, joined Fleetwood Mac in 1970 after marrying the band's bassist, John McVie, and performed with the group for nearly 30 years before leaving the band. In 1998, McVie was inducted to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as a member of that group. Her former bandmates expressed their condolences, calling McVie a one-of-a-kind talent. There's no words to describe our sadness at the passing of Christine McVie, the group said in a statement. She was truly one of a kind, special and talented beyond measure. She was the best musician anyone could have in their band and the best friend anyone could have in their life. We were so lucky to have a life with her. Individually and together, we cherish Christine deeply and are thankful for the amazing memories we have. She will be so very missed, the band added. Steve Nicks, who joined Fleetwood Mac in 1975, posted a heartfelt handwritten note on Twitter in which she lamented the unexpected loss. A few hours ago, I was told that my best friend in the whole world since the first day of 1975 had passed away, Nicks wrote. I didn't even know she was ill until late Saturday night, she continued. I wanted to be in London. I wanted to get to London, but we were told to wait. So since Saturday, one song has been swirling around in my head over and over and over again. I thought I might possibly get to sing it to her, and so I'm singing it to her now. I always knew I would need these words one day. Nick's letter included the lyrics to Haim's 2020 song, Hallelujah, which read in part, I had a best friend, but she has come to pass, one I wish I could see now. You always remind me that memories will last. These arms reach out. See you on the other side, my love. Don't forget me. Always, Stevie. Nicks concludes in the note. And in country music with a local touch, we have this article entitled, How to Watch North Carolina Film George and Tammy Limited TV Series. This is published in the News and Observer on the 4th of December, 2022, by Corey Dean. When the highly anticipated limited series chronicling the relationship and careers of country music stars George Jones and Tammy Wynette premieres Sunday, viewers in North Carolina may recognize familiar settings and faces. George and Tammy, a six-part series, stars Oscar winner Jessica Chastain as Wynette, and Michael Shannon as Jones, along with an impressive ensemble class of other recognizable and accomplished actors. The show chronicles Wynette and Jones's complicated but enduring relationship as a country music power couple, which inspired some of the most iconic music of all time. The series was filmed in Wilmington beginning last December. Production was primarily based at Dark Horse Studios with some stage space used at EUE Screen Gem Studios and on-location spots around the coastal city also making cameos. The series was awarded funds for production expenses as part of the North Carolina Film and Entertainment Grant Rebate Program. George and Tammy will premiere on Showcase and Showtime and the Paramount Network Sunday night before moving exclusively to Showtime. Before the series premiere, we have more about the show's North Carolina connections, plus information on the cast and how to watch. Here's what to know. Filmed in North Carolina, other ties to the state. George and Tammy was one of 71 productions to file registration paperwork for film activity in North Carolina last year, and one of 25 productions to be awarded future rebates for production expenses as part of the state film and entertainment grant program, according to a March news release from the state film office. Collectively, production last year spent more than $416 million in the state, the film's office, March's release says. That was a single-year record for in-state spending by productions in North Carolina, though when adjusted for inflation, the investment total was roughly equal to the state's previous record, which was set in 2012 when Iron Man 3 and other productions invested $373 million in the state. George and Tammy was expected to have a direct in-state spend in excess of $48 million. Guy Gaster, director of North Carolina Film Office, told the News and Observer in an email, "The series, filmed both in-studio and on locations around Wilmington, viewers may recognize Thalian Hall and The Rusty Nail, two of the downtown Wilmington's locations that were used for filming. Viewers should also keep an eye and ear out for Chatham County Line, the enduring real-life North Carolina-based band that formed about two decades ago. Band members Dave Wilson, John Teer, Dan Hall, and Greg Redling appear in the series as various members of the Nashville A-Team, a session group that backed popular singers between the 1950s and 70s. We are currently excited to see the show on the screen and reflect that work of many North Carolinians who were part of the crew and efforts behind the earners," Caster told the News and Observer. Episode show on Sundays at 9 p.m. showtime. So how did you do on today's trivia questions? Well, the answer to our first question, Thurl Ravenscroft sang "You're a Mean One, Mr. Grinch" in the 1966 classic How the Grinch Stole Christmas. What non-holiday fictional character did Ravenscroft famously voice? Was it A, Darth Vader? Was it B, Tony the Tiger? Was it C, Bugs Bunny? Or was it D, Alvin from the Chipmunks? Correct answer. Answer B, Tony the Tiger. As noted in characters.fandom.com, Tony the Tiger is the advertising cartoon mascot for Kellogg's Frosted Flakes breakfast cereal, appearing on its packaging and advertising. In 1951, Eugene Kolke, an accomplished graphic artist and art director for Leo Burnett, sketched a character for a contest to become the official mascot of a Kellogg's brand new breakfast cereal. Kolke designed a tiger named Tony. The final Tony the Tiger design came from a group of former Disney animators known as Quartet Films, which also designed the Jolly Green Giant, Snap, Crackle, and Pop, the Ham's Beer Bear, and the Baltimore Orioles mascot, among others. A recognizable and distinct voice was needed for the Tony the Tiger character. Initially, he was voiced by Dallas McKinnon, but shortly afterwards, McKinnon was replaced by Thurl Ravenscroft, who spent the next 5 decades providing the characteristic deep bass voice associated with the character, notably the familiar "They're great" catchphrase. Ravenscroft spoke for an interviewer of injecting the personality into Tony. "I made Tony a person. For me, Tony was real. I made him become a human being, and that affected the animation and everything." Ravenscroft also sang "You're a Mean One, Mr. Grinch" for the 1966 classic How the Grinch Stole Christmas. He passed away in 2005. Mascots such as Tony the Tiger and Coco the Monkey were axed in 2017 by new rules designed to tackle childhood obesity. Food and drink giants such as Kellogg's were no longer allowed to target under 16s with advertising for products high in salt, fat, and sugar. Bye-bye, Tony. And the answer to our second question, which comic actor sang the now gold-certified the Hanukkah song? Was that A, Adam Sandler, B, Bob Newhart, C, Steve Martin, or D, Jim Carrey? Correct answer Adam Sandler. As noted in the article Best Hanukkah Songs on 11/28/21 by Sophia Smith in YouDiscoverMusic.com, when actor and comedian Adam Sandler unveiled his ode to Hanukkah on Saturday Night Live in 1994, he was introducing the world to a new holiday classic. It's easily the number one best Hanukkah song in pop culture history. As noted in History.com on 29th of November 2022, the eight-day Jewish celebration known as Hanukkah commemorates the rededication during the 2nd century B.C. of the Second Temple of Jerusalem, where, according to legend, Jews had risen up against the Greek-Syrian oppressors in the Maccabean Revolt. Hanukkah, which means dedication in Hebrew, usually falls in November or December, and this year it begins on the evening of Sunday, December 18th, and ends on the evening of Monday, December 26th. Often called the Festival of Lights, the holiday is celebrated with the lighting of the menorah, traditional foods, games, and gifts. Sophia Smith notes that many of the best-loved Christmas songs, including White Christmas, The Christmas Song, Chestnuts Roasting on an Open Fire, and Let It Snow, Let It Snow, Let It Snow, were written by Jewish artists, including Irving Berlin, Mel Torme, and Robert Wells, and Sammy Kahn, and Julie Stein. So let's close out today's program with Nat King Cole's The Christmas Song, written by Jewish artist Mel Torme and Bob Wells in 1944.
Chestnuts roasting on an open fire, Jack Frost nipping at your nose, Yuletide carols being sung by a choir, and folks dressed up like Eskimos.
Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Music Review. Be sure to tune in at the same time next week. This program is also available as a podcast after the broadcast in our website, ncreadingservice.org. As we leave you now, remember these words. Kindness is a language which blind people see and deaf people hear. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. If you have a suggestion for music to feature on this program, please leave a message for me at 919-832-5138. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Music Review is underwritten by Bill McClure, tuning pianos in the Raleigh area since 1968. For more information or to schedule a piano tuning, please call 919-779-1755. So long. Until next time.
Although it's been said many times, many ways, Merry Christmas to you.